In this session on sermon structure, we are finally moving to step 6 out of the 7 steps. So we're making our way to the end. Now we all know that 6 out of 7. So this is structure now, all right? Now we all realize that buildings need structure. If the building you're in right now did not have some good structure, it would have fallen many years ago. This building was made in 1968, was built in 1968. It's got great structure in it. That's why it's lasted so long. This is actually our most solid building on campus. Did you know that? Block 1, the oldest one. Do you know why? This building was built to be 4 stories high, but it's only 3 stories. It has a foundation strong enough to add another story on it. At the time that it was built in 1968, all buildings in this part of Singapore were allowed to be 3 stories high. They've since changed the law, and they knew that they would change the law. So they said, let's just get a good enough foundation so eventually we can add another story on. Well, we haven't done that, but we've built many other buildings on campus instead. But buildings need structure, sermons do as well. And so what I'm going to do is evaluate your structure on your homework that you're handing in today. Did everybody hand in their homework? Okay. And what I'm going to do is I had you all read page 22 as part of the assignment and use page 22 as a bit of a checklist, really, for your outline on Colossians 4:6. Here's an outline of Colossians 4:6 that one of my students did many years ago. And here's how I marked it. Instead of saying these long sentences on it, because I really didn't have enough room, I just put numbers on it in the left-hand column that correlated with page 22. So I say on there, page 22 points. And the idea there is you keep page 22 handy, and then as I evaluate the outline, you just kind of look up these things on page 22. All right. So, for example, I've got questions on the text here. And I put a number 1 there, and I minus 1% for this. Well, the student asked some questions related to the text, but didn't answer them. So, question number 1 says, in terms of how I grade it, you just look on page 22, the checklist, and you'll see. Have you written out your questions and answers on the text? Of the text and the text itself at the top? The student did the text itself, so I give credit for that, but didn't really give the answers. So I thought, okay, at least should probably take off at least 1 point for that. Next, here's the exegetical idea. Believers should always be ready to answer questions graciously. Well, it's not really written in a Z1X, Z2Y form, is it? So I added here, the way Colossian believers should do this. And so I wrote over here, 2. That means I'm taking off 3 points. Right? I think, yeah, 3 points I say at the top of page 22. Minus 3% for each one missing. So, but then I also have 20 here. Next to the exegetical idea. What does that mean? Well, you just go look up 20, and you'll see it says, is the focus the recipients in the past tense? The student really didn't do it. The student didn't bring in the idea that this was written actually initially to the Colossians. So at the exegetical level, it should be relating to the original audience. And this student was jumping all the way into, here's a general principle for all of us. Now, I think it's legitimate that what Colossians 4:6 said for them is applicable to us as well, but the student is jumping ahead of himself or herself to do that. And then I also have 6 here. I wrote a 6 here. Why a 6? Believers should always be ready to answer questions graciously and effectively concerning their faith, and be ready to share about God, His redemption, and a personal testimony before everyone. Well, I think it's good for us all to be able to share about God. It's good for us to share about His redemption and give your personal testimony. But where is that in the verse? So that's where I said that. Where is this in verse 6? I mean, you're just inserting stuff in the verse that's really not there. This would be an exegetical idea, meaning you're getting out of the text and not putting stuff into it. So I ask, is the exegetical idea and the outline exegesis true to the author's intent? I don't think this is true to the author's intent. Maybe the student getting ahead of himself a bit, starting to think how he's going to preach this passage. 19 was the other one. I put a 19 there. Do the subpoints or main points avoid ideas not in the text? That's a similar idea. You can preach wonderful theology from the wrong text. So we don't want to preach the theology of some other text. We want to preach what's in that text. Okay, it is in context with other verses.
With this verse 5, we're talking about like how you deal with outsiders, which would affect how you interpret verse 6.
It is true that verse 5 is talking about outsiders or non-Christians.
Right.
So we want that idea to be brought into verse 6.
So but then it kind of looks like it's not in the text. It's
not okay. I think it's where when we get to anyone, the word anyone in verse 6, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. That's in the context of verse 5. And I'm okay. Some of you may think that this is relating, these are talking about our speech in general to Christians and non-Christians. Because you're saying, well, verse 5 talks about non-Christians, but you go up to verse 2, and he talks about... Well, does he talk about Christians in verse 2? Pray for open door to non-Christians. He's actually... I think in the context, he's really talking about non-Christians. But yes, we want to get the context. What you have in verse 6 is going to be obviously influenced by what you have in the verses preceding. So I wouldn't mark you down by saying if you're saying this relates to non-Christians, because you're taking that from the context. I think there's actually more of a defined everyone here in verse 6. He's talking about every non-Christian, but you might disagree with me on that. And if you support your view, you know, normally I don't hassle with that kind of thing. I want to make sure that you're being clear and you know why you're saying what you're saying. That's more important to me. All right? Then I put for the first main point. Do you see where the first main point? Do you see a second main point? There isn't one. So the student really hasn't broken down the passage. And so I wrote a 22 there at the side. Does each point have a coordinating point? I mean, if you've got a main point 1, you've got to have a main point 2. I just crossed out that main point 1. I just said omit. And these A and B actually will become the main points of the passage. I also put number 2 here. Are the exegetical ID, the EI, and the main points all written in proper Z1X, Z2Y form? They're really not. This one's not. This one's not. A and B or 1 and 2 are not. Does each sentence in the outline include its correct verse? You should have what part of the passage you're talking about put in parentheses, in this case 6A and 6B, it should be clear in your outline where you're actually getting those points from in your passage. In this case, we're only doing one verse, so we're doing 6A or 6B, 6C, etc. And then I put a 16 here. Do statements translate figures of speech rather than using the text's words? The student said, oh, I'm just going to be really biblical here. Believers' speech must be seasoned with salt. And I'm like, okay, you think you're being real biblical there, but you're really telling me you have no idea what that means, right? What does that mean, seasoned with salt? So to be able to clarify that, you have to think about, well, how was salt used? And I'm sure you've gone through this process, right? Here's where background can be very, very helpful. Do we use salt the same way now as they did back then? What's different? What's the same? Etc. Number 9 I put, where is result in your outline? Does at least one Z1 in the MPs match that of the EI? The student said, the result of believer's speech will always be with grace seasoned with salt. I'm kind of like, really? Is that verse talking about the result of your speech will be grace? Is that the result? And if this passage is about the result being grace and seasoned with salt, what's the cause? I didn't quite catch it. But one of these main points, the Z1 and one of these main points, should be brought on up into your exegetical idea. And there's not a sense of clarity there. I know this sounds perhaps really technical to you, and most things do when you first are learning a skill. But later on, it'll become pretty obvious to you. I like this. These guys say, I'm a reporter from Unsolved Mysteries, and we'd like to do a story of your last sermon. That's the kind of reporter you don't want to show up, you know, like, your sermon is an unsolved mystery, and we need your help to understand it. The reality is nobody's going to come to you and say, Pastor, that was really I just didn't catch at all what you're saying. Could you help me with it? They're not going to say that because they're going to be afraid you're going to lose face doing that, and they're going to say, well, I was pretty dumb, you know, I didn't quite catch it. People will blame themselves. Well, a lot of us will blame ourselves before we blame our pastors. Some of us blame our pastors before we blame ourselves, you know? I don't know.
Well, what do you do, pastoring, with people who've shared? This is what I learned, but that wasn't part of your sermon.
If they say, God blessed me in a way that you weren't expecting, I say, thank God, you know? Praise the Lord, but hopefully they got the main idea of what I'm trying to say. Maybe they are actually applying that, but there was a minor point in my sermon that the Holy Spirit used to work on their heart, and they gained some good things from that. I'll be happy with that.
But you don't correct them.
I could correct them. I could say, you know, the key thing I was trying to say was this. I wonder, did you catch that? That was what I was trying to say. Most of my people don't have a problem understanding me. Why? I give a detailed sermon outline, and I give the main idea right there. The word to fill in the blank is in yellow. I don't try to treat them like children, but I try to be so clear that they'll look at me and go, okay, that's clear. And is that, do I need to do that? How do I need to do that? You know, that kind of idea. If they're searching for what I'm trying to say, they're certainly not going to apply it to their lives. They have to have understanding first before they're going to have application. So, yeah, I'm a bit concerned when people are applying stuff that I never said. But I don't normally have that problem because clarity for me is my priority to a fault. I need to work on other aspects of my preaching more than my clarity. Every preacher has their strong points and weak points. So one of my strong points is clarity. One of my weak points is just heart you know? I want to grab you. I want you to catch this idea, you know? I want the right story and application that's going to change your life. That's what Dr. Des and his teachers call pathos. I need to grow in that area of pathos, that emotional unction, that emotional... What is it?
Anointing.
Okay, I wouldn't use the word anointing. I wouldn't use the word anointing because I'm too theologically literate to use that word. Because I know it from 1 John. John says in his epistle, you all have the anointing. So I'm affected by that, you know. Well, all creatures need skeleton, right? We'd be a really pretty, pretty sad shape if we didn't have skeleton. And sermons needed as well. So this session is designed to help us to understand how you actually give skeleton, how you actually give structure to your sermon. So we have made our way to step 6. We've made our way around the circle here. Once you have the central proposition of the sermon or the homiletical idea, now we're going to be here for a little bit, a few sessions, to talk about the homiletical outline, how to be clear, a session on clarity. We'll have a session on introductions and conclusions. Haddon Robinson, he unpacks these in 3 different steps. Ramesh Richards sums it up just in the one word, structure. Either way, you're basically getting the same teaching as the other preaching class with Dr. Des. He's just explaining this in 3 steps. I'm explaining the same step in 3 sessions, teaching sessions. So what's the difference? The main thing is you get the basic idea. Dr. Des and I were good buddies, and we really have the same philosophy of preaching and helping students preach from the text. But there's different ways to go about it. Of course, your question is, how should I structure my sermon? You're going to need to know how to do that to take your Colossians 4:6 outline, and how are you going to actually take that and turn it into a sermon outline? That's what this session is designed to do, to give you some skills in doing that. You don't want to be like Reverend Billings. It occurs to Reverend Billings in the middle of point 2 that point 3 misses the point entirely. It sounds funny, but it's not so funny, because I've been there in the pulpit and I'm going, one time I was preaching, I realized, wow, I'm totally off base. I totally missed this. And I'm like, this is frightening. I should have studied this better, you know. And so when I got to point 3, I said, well, you know, you've got this in your outline, but it's not really correct. So like I was telling someone today, we were comparing dissertations, and she said, she was telling me about her dissertation, and I said, well, I can tell you about my dissertation. I don't agree with it. I got a PhD and a 424-page dissertation, but I don't agree with it anymore. On a rather major point. That's because my dissertation, and I got my doctorate in my development. That's kind of where I was back in 1990. But thank God I've grown a little bit since 1990. And I have hopefully a clearer theology, so I won't give you all the details about that, but it relates to the doctrine of perseverance and all that. But anyway, get your structure done early is a good way to do it. If you're working on structure Saturday night, you're probably not going to be clear Sunday morning. You know, these things kind of, they have to gel. I'm going to work on my sermon tonight. It's Tuesday. I want to get that, the main idea, and I'm going to have 2 points? 3 points. I'm going to have 3 points this Sunday. I want to get that down. That's one of my goals. Get that done before I go to bed tonight. Then I have a few more days to think about how am I actually going to, you know, unpack that for my congregation on Sunday. Page 47 is a very, very helpful guide in respect to types of sermon structure. And I have adapted this from Haddon Robinson. As I have in your notes, I probably should put that on the slide as well. He won't be disappointed because he's in heaven with Jesus now, so he's not even looking at this. But everybody agrees you pretty much have an introduction, a body, and a conclusion to your sermon, any kind of speech. So deductive is one way in which you can structure that speech with those three parts. In a deductive speech, you give your CPS right at the beginning. You say, today we are going to see that love is more important than spiritual gifts. We're going to look at 1 Corinthians 13 today, and here's the basic idea. My CPS. You wouldn't tell your people that it's a CPS, so they go, what? But you're basically saying, today we're going to say love is more important than spiritual gifts. I think that's really the central idea of 1 Corinthians 13. That's what you say at the beginning of your sermon. You'll go through your sermon, and if you've done it correctly, each of the two or three or four points of your sermon are going to contribute to that idea of the superiority of love over gifts. When you get to the end, you should restate the CPS. You should say it again. Today what we have seen is that love is more important than spiritual gifts. Now I'll restate it. You know, sometimes we get our whole abilities as our focus instead of really whether we're caring about people. So focus ends up being us and how we do this or that rather than whether we really live for ourselves or live for others. Do you see how I'm restating it? Nope. And then I'll move to application. How about you? Where's your focus? I'll apply it to you as students at Singapore Bible College. Where's your focus right now? As first-year students. Are you guys doing what you know you shouldn't do? Are you shifting toward, yeah, I really need to get all these skills? And you neglect to see that the greatest skill you could ever have is love? If so, you're getting a little off balance. So here's my fatherly, gentle warning or rebuke to you. Learn from the Corinthians. They got all focused on their abilities. And you know, when you're focused on your abilities, you're focused on yourself. Can I do this well? Do I do this? Do I come across very well here? am I growing and doing this better, speaking this better? And they were all caught up in Corinth. And I shouldn't keep going on this because I'll preach 1 Corinthians to you all. But you get the idea? On a deductive, you've already deduced in your mind what that central idea is. And you've stated it at the beginning of your sermon. Maybe you'll state it two or three or four times. Dr. Dez does this in his message. Oftentimes, he'll give that central idea five times in his sermon. By the time you get to the end, you pretty much have gotten it. You know? Good for repetition. And so you're kind of growing it out. By the time you get to the end, you state it. All right? The opposite type of sermon structure is the inductive structure. And that is where you only state the theme. Or in Robinson's terms, the subject. You're just giving the subject. You're just giving the question that you're going to address in your sermon at the beginning. Then you go through your sermon, you develop issues related to that question, but you don't actually state the full CPS. You don't give the main idea until you get to the end of the sermon. And so it's kind of inverted. You're channeling all your statements all the way to the end, so you're honing in on that main idea at the end. It's a very different way to speak, but a good way to do it as well. And sometimes you may want to combine the two. You start off inductively. You state your theme. Maybe your first point relates to answering the question of your theme, and then you move on in and state your CPS, or maybe a portion of your CPS. And then you move on in, and then finally, it's not till the end where you get the full statement of your CPS or restating your CPS. My Matthew 18 message is somewhat like this. So yeah, I don't raise the question, why should we restore sinning believers at the beginning of my sermon? I say, how do we do this? Well, we do it by keeping the matter as private as possible. And a lot of people say, oh, okay, I think I got the whole sermon. I go, no, there's three more verses, 18, 19, and 20. We got to talk about the binding and the loosing and all that. And where two or three are together, there I am in their midst. Huh? Oh, we got to add that part to it. That's going to help me get the full CPS. I'm not talking about the exact same thing that we have here, but I'm talking about stating maybe inductively and then stating another, really the subject of the passage at the middle of my message. Why do we restore sinning believers correctly? If we're going to answer that question, we do answer it, then I think we've answered all six verses, all going from verses 15 to 20 by the time we get to the end. Okay? All right. Your questions about these three structure, Natalie? I don't have a preference in terms of which way you do it. Each of us are going to have, a different style. But well, let's talk about advantages. What would be advantages of the first one, the deductive?
Audience knows.
The audience knows. They know right at the beginning. Is that advantage? Because it's what's the advantage there? What's the advantage of letting your audience know right at the beginning? Here's the central idea we're talking about today.
They can link whatever you're going to say.
Yeah, they've got a structure. They go, okay, we're going to talk about this. He says love is more important than spiritual gifts. I'm going to be looking for that as the speaker goes on through. I'm going to go see if that's really correct. Is that what love is more important than spiritual gifts? Is that what verse 1 says? If I speak of the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Hey, actually, it is. I always thought that verse 1 was about love. No. It's about love more important than spiritual gifts. If I prophesy and I know all mysteries and all knowledge and have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I'm nothing. Wow. Hey, that's right. Paul says love's more important than prophecy and knowledge. And if I give my body to be burned, the listener can go, wow, this is really clear. I thought 1 Corinthians 13 was about just the love chapter. I just thought it was about love. No. It's about the priority of love over gifts. Do you catch what I'm saying? So you stating that up front can be, you're being really clear, and your audience can kind of evaluate you. You kind of say, am I interpreting this correctly as we go through? You check me, okay? Let's see if what I'm telling you is actually what's in this passage. Now, what's the advantage of the middle one, the inductive one? I think that's the key one. It's more interesting. Why is it more interesting, Lisa? Very good. They're journeying with you the whole way. So they can look at all the trees along the way and kind of like, hey, where is this going to go? I've been in some of these games, with groups where the groups are going together. They don't know where it's actually going to end up, but it's kind of fun, You get the clues along the way and you don't know whether you're going to end up at down at the sea or at the Bible college or at the Botanic Gardens or whatever, but it really draws interest along the way. And it's the same way kind of for a sermon like that. Also, what are you actually introducing at the beginning?
A question.
And hopefully that question is a question everybody is wondering about. If I ask, how do you treat your mother-in-law? Is that going to really excite all of you here? A lot of you are going, I don't have a mother-in-law. That's not really a good question to ask. But if I if I generalize a little more, how do you treat someone who's maybe not treating you so well? Maybe a mother-in-law might be one of those people. Maybe a father-in-law, maybe a roommate, maybe a sister, and maybe somebody else. I'm broadening it like that. I'm bringing enough interest in it where hopefully the passage will help you in that particular relationship. So what I did last Sunday, I said, today we're going to talk about affirming the afflicted. Do you know someone who's afflicted? I said, how many of you know someone who's going through difficulty? Raise your hand. And I get like 10% of the congregation raising their hand. I just told them, I said, I don't accept that. Surely every one of you knows somebody who's going through some difficult time in their life. Don't you? Think a little bit more. At work, in your family, with your friends, surely 90% of you don't know anybody who's going through difficulty. I want them to identify something and then say, oh wow, maybe this sermon can help bless that person as I go through. So, the advantage of the third one is variety. You kind of shake it up a little bit. You sort of like, if they're used to a question with three points, every sermon, all your sermons are going to sound very much the same. It's good to preach as much as you can the way the text preaches it, but it's good to throw in some variety. Sometimes preach a deductive sermon, other times preach inductive, other times inductive, deductive, you know? Now, the question, let me reword Natalie's question from earlier. Which of these three is the worst one to use? Maybe I could ask which is the best to use, but let me ask which is the worst one to use? Of these three. Yeah. Let me tell you which one is the worst one to use. It's the one that you use all the time. That's the worst one to use. Know your own tendency. If your tendency is to always use a deductive sermon, well, then realize that and say, boy, I need to learn how to do more inductive preaching. My tendency is to use inductive sermons, two or three points, and I need to think more in terms of, well, how can I actually use the other two? How can I not be so predictable? Everybody knows. Not like my wife's pastor. He pastored the same church for 23 years, you know, and he always had 3 points. And once he got into the poem at the end, which he had a poem every week, and he was very interested in poetry, and he didn't read his poems, he memorized his poems. So he very eloquently went into his poem at the end. Once he got into the poem, you know, people packing up, you know, they're about ready. They got about everything ready to leave church by the time he finished his poem, because he's so predictable, you know. And what we want to avoid, always sounding the same, all of our sermons always ending up the same way. Levy, what's your thought?
The reason for changing it up is for people not to be bored.
Yeah, you're a lot more interesting if you're less predictable. Natalie?
Do you think there are texts which lend themselves more naturally to one or the other?
I do think there are certain texts, certain topics you want to sort of just kind of move on in. I was preaching in Malachi chapter 2 last month, a guest speaker. They asked me to speak on that passage because it relates to divorce. Maybe that was why they asked me. Let's go get the guest speaker talk about divorce. As a pastor's like, I'm not touching that thing with a 10-foot pole, you know? So I came in, you know, Malachi 2, God says, I hate divorce. well, that's pretty clear. On that passage, I didn't think it was very good to preach a deductive sermon. I didn't want to come in and say, okay, let's all open our Bibles to Malachi 2, and we'll see where God hates divorce. Just right there, I'm going to turn off half of the congregation. Some saying, hey, you don't realize how difficult it is for people that go through divorce. Others say, well, I was divorced, and I know God hates it, but do you have to be so blunt about, I mean, you haven't even heard my story, you know what I mean? I can just turn off so many people right at the beginning of my sermon. So that's the exact opposite of what a good speaker wants to do. A good speaker wants to pull people in to the message and not set up all these barriers right at the beginning. So if you're dealing with something controversial, generally you're going to want to go to an inductive message.
You can also, like, a prologue, right?
A prologue, yeah.
Before you say the movie.
Yeah.
So it's
let's say at the end of your introduction, then you say God hates divorce. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
You can.
Still at the start.
I mean, there's so many ways to do this. What you don't want to do is you don't want to say, to balance last week's 20-point sermon, today's message will be pointless. In this regard, I say keep your points short in number and style. Don't have these long main points like we had some examples of earlier. Either the main idea or the main points of your sermon. When they're really long, people just don't catch them. You've worked through them. You're familiar with the passage. You've studied it for hours. But they're just coming at it cold. They've been doing other things during the week while you've been working on your sermon. And so I suggest 2, 3, 4 main points. And I used to say, I'm going to keep them 1 to 2 lines. Now I'm saying, no, one line. When I type it out, it's going to go one line on my computer. If it jumps to the second line, I need to reword it. That means generally, 5 to 8 words, something like that. Life is too complex. I don't need my complex sermon to further inflict their lives, All right, now there's two key issues you're going to need to do. And if you turn to page 138, this is a really important concept here. Yeah. This will help you to know where to put, for example, your main idea. If you're going to do your main idea, state your main idea. Well, you need to know, which you should. By the way, I find that most sermons I hear, nobody ever states the main idea. They just assume the listeners are going to, well, it's in there. It's figure it out yourself, And I think, you're the speaker. Tell me what the main idea is, what you think it is, I think you should really state it for people. In an inductive sermon, you're not going to state it until you get to the end, right? Because you're going to start with just your theme, or you're going to start with your subject or your question at the beginning. In a deductive sermon, you're stating that main idea right at the beginning of the sermon. Today we're going to see God hates divorce. Or today we're going to see love is more important than gifts, or whatever it might be. There's a second question you need to decide, and that is, where am I going to apply the passage? And you have two basic options. One of them is you're going to apply it only one time. It's very simple. You go through the passage, then you apply the passage. So you give it only application only once. But there is a cyclical approach that you could use as well, where you are applying the passage as you go through. Let's say you have divided your passage up into three portions. You explain the first portion, you go with that, and then you apply it at that point. You explain the middle part of your passage, and then you apply it. And then you explain the last part of your passage, and then you apply it. That's called a cyclical method or cyclical application. So put the two together, where you put the main idea and where you put the application. And in a simple inductive form, let's see, help me out here. Clevy, maybe you can help me out. So tell me what a simple inductive message structure is like. What are you actually doing?
Main ideas.
Okay, you're waiting to the end to give your main idea. And what about your application? Okay, you're keeping that at the end. So you're going through the entire passage. State the main idea, apply the main idea. Quite simple. How about a cyclical inductive? Winston, how would you explain a cyclical inductive sermon structure?
So you keep repeating the application.
Okay, you're repeating the application.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're keeping the main idea for the end. So you're bringing up a relevant question at the beginning, and then there's maybe two, three, four parts to the answer or four answers to it. All right. Stella, how about you? Simple inductive or simple deductive? What's that? You start with the main idea. Good. And then how much of the passage do you talk about before you apply it in a simple... Yeah, you're going to go all the way through the passage, then you apply the whole passage all at once. All right? Cyclical deductive. Gavin, how about that one?
Main idea first.
Good, start with the main idea. And you're applying it as you go through. You see that? Isn't that cool? Those are four different types of structure. You can use any of these in this class that will, the way you think will help apply the passage the best. You can say, yeah.
The cyclical application, is that just like one application point that you repeat multiple times or is it different?
It's different applications as you go through, generally. So you can say, for example, hey, do you want to talk to non-Christians in the proper way? We'll want to do that, right? Be gracious. Let's talk about that. How can you be gracious? What does that look like if you're gracious? See, I'm applying it. I'm applying Colossians 4:6. Well, gracious, some say that means you're speaking of God's grace. Others says that means that you're speaking in a manner that's winsome and attractive, kind of. Whatever you think be gracious means. Let your speech always be with grace. You have to unpack what that means. You have to apply what that means. Okay, we got that down. Now let's go. What else does Paul say? Seasoned as it were with salt. That means if you're going to speak to non-Christians, you should whatever you think that means. Now, how do we apply that? Let's say you mean that you think that means to be wise. Seasoned as it were with salt. You don't take salt and just dump it all on your food. You know? You season it. You have a little bit of salt, you know? How can you do that with non-Christians when you talk to non-Christians? So then you're applying that aspect. That would be a cyclical. Let me give you a quick... a way to go through it, and then we'll take a break. Let's say you're preaching on Acts 6, familiar to you, right? When church growth problems arise, how should we solve them? The church at Jerusalem was growing, right? Well, they had a problem with, the problem was, I guess you could say it was a growth, but they had a food problem. The Greek-speaking Jews, Jewish widows, were being overlooked in the food distribution. They couldn't speak Aramaic like there in Jerusalem. Maybe these ladies have come in from other places to Jerusalem. And so the way they solved that problem is they designated leaders. So when church growth problems arise, how should we solve them? Well, designate leaders to help resolve those. So the solution to the problems of a growing church is lay leaders. So there's our main idea. Do you see how it's simple, inductive? He hasn't applied it yet. We're going to do that on the third point. The solution to our problems, here's where we begin to apply them. I found this very helpful. Don Snookin, my preaching professor, gave this outline. So it is a simple inductive. You're only raising a question at the beginning, and you go all the way through the passage, verses 1-6 all together. You state the main idea, and you apply the main idea. It's a very clear way to actually preach a sermon. This is essentially your exegetical ideas. Apostles solve the problems of growth with lay leadership. This is in parentheses because it's inductively developed. In other words, when you ask the question in your introduction, how should we solve these church growth problems? Well, Jerusalem was growing. They had a food problem. They designated lay leaders. You're actually not stating the full point here. Logically, these are A, B, and C. They fit under the main point one here. But in terms of the order in which you're speaking, it doesn't work that way. Basically, you've got an exegetical idea saying they designated lay leaders to solve their church growth problems. You could do that. You could preach the same passage in a cyclical manner, though. You start with the same subject. Page 49 has this outline as well. This church, like ours, was growing. Their church is growing. We're growing. We've got, but growing churches have problems. They had a food problem. We don't have a food problem. This is Singapore. Too much food in Singapore. That's our food problem, But we have other problems. We have a parking problem. We've got X number of people, and we've got 10 parking spaces, Whatever. There's other problems that we have with church growth here in Singapore that the Jerusalem church didn't have. But you're applying that. So you're applying the problem of growth, and you're applying the problems of problems with growth. And then the solutions have lay leaders. Well, they designated these seven men. They called the seven. And they took care of the food issue. We need to designate. We need more deacons. We need more elders. Probably maybe deacons would be the way to help resolve these things. Do you see how you're going through and you're actually applying it three times? And people will go, they'll say, this whole sermon is applicable. And kind of helpful. So you actually start basically with the principle with 1, 2, and 3. At the A level, you give the text. The text of first part of verse 1, second part of verse 1, and then 2-6. And then point B is actually the application. I call it the PTA. Principle, text, application. Principle, text, application. Principle, text, application. And many times I'll preach this structure so that I am applying as I go through. And people will go, wow, okay, this actually does apply. Simple deductive might be, yes, Nellie? Okay, if you want to keep the application at the end.
But would you still recommend that as you're walking through the text, you're bridging the then to now divide, at least not in terms of how you apply it, but in terms of context, I guess. So in this sense, right? Like
on this one, you are applying as you go through. But are you talking about the simple? You're talking about the simple inductive. You're keeping in your mind where you're actually going to go in terms of application.
Oh, no, because I guess in my mind, an application is just for them to be doing something, right? So their church was growing, we are growing, it's not an application. It's just the comparison of how they were. Do you see what I mean?
Well, it is applying the point of that's in common with the text with us. It's not a therefore we must do this. It's not a command, but it is applying the text to us, showing where what we see in the text shows up in ourselves today. Now you could go a simple deductive. You start at the beginning of your sermon and you give the full idea. When church growth problems arise, we should solve them with lay leadership. Okay? That's what we're going to look at today. We're moving on toward lay leadership. The Jerusalem church problem, they grew, they had a food problem, they designated lay leaders. We're going to do the same. And I'm going to restate the main idea that I said at the beginning of the message. We're growing, we have these problems, we need to designate lay leaders. In essence, points A and A are parallel, B and B are parallel, C and C are parallel. That's a little tough to see when you see the outline like this. It's even tougher to hear. Okay, do you remember that point A before? Now we're going to do point A with applying to us. Remember point B before? Well, now we're going to apply point B to most people. Your goal is not for them to go, okay, that was a major point, that was a sub point. This is the sub-sub of the sub-point relating to the first sub of the sub-point. You know, that's not your goal. Your goal is not for them to memorize your sermon outline. It's to understand the text and apply it to their life. But having this idea of where to put the main idea, where to put the application and all that, hopefully will be helpful. So what I want you to do in your outline for next week is I want you to tell me which one of these four that you're actually going to use. All right, that's part of your assignment when you do the sermon outline for Colossians 4:6. I will grade your papers, I'll give them back to you, and it's your job to turn them into a basic sermon outline. Tell me which one of these four that you're going to use, and then do it. Show me actually how you're doing it. All right? Let me jump to slide 17, and then we'll take a break. Basically, you're going from passage outline to sermon outline. All right? Let's suppose your passage outline is the reason the church restores sinning creation correctly is because it extends God's authority. And then you believe that 15 to 17 are manner, 18 to 20 are reason. What's your sermon outline going to look like? You could do it different ways, but the way I chose to do it is to take the manner and shift it up to the beginning of the sermon. How do we restore sinning Christians properly? So I share a story. Boy, we had this person, and the person fell into sin. What should you do? What should you do in a situation like that? I'm bringing a relevant story or something. Well, Scripture says keep the matter as private as possible. Here's how Jesus says. You've got four steps, and you don't go blab the problem, you know? Then, at the middle of the sermon, I'm actually giving the Z1. Well, why? Why can we even seek to restore sinning members? Why do we do this? And then main point two gives the answer, but it's still a full sentence. Our church extends the authority of God himself. So I end the sermon. We must restore sinning members properly because we act on God's behalf. Or I could just say, take off the we must. Just say, restore sinning members because you act for God. Something like that. So the exegetical outline or exegetical idea of the passage outline ends up at the end here. Okay, now, what kind of outline is this? Tell the person next to you which one of those four outlines this is. Which one of those four is this one right here? Talk to the person next to you. Is it simple or is it cyclical? And then is it inductive or is it deductive? Where's the main idea? Where's the application? All right. Where's the main idea? Beginning or end? It's at the end. And where's the application? Is it once or is it appearing cyclical? So it's cycling through. Therefore, we have a cyclical inductive message here. All right, that's what I want you to do for your sermon outline that you turn in next week.